You're listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information, visit abc.net.au/conversations. Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Now, before we start today, I should say that if you've got little kids in earshot of this, today's conversation might be one to hear as a podcast and saved up for a later time, or maybe you can just shoo the kids outside, depending on your mood. Okay, now let's proceed. There is a point that you reach in life when you look back at a picture of your much younger self and you think, my God, who is that person and what on earth is that outfit I'm wearing in that picture? When Kate Colden has that moment, and she may have had it already, it'll be a little more powerful than most of us. 5 years ago, Kate Colden released her memoir called In My Skin, and in it she told the story of her young life, a little girl who hated to miss out, who became a young woman who was tempted into using heroin and eventually became a prostitute to support her habit. Today, Kate is a successful writer, and she's been off heroin for many years, and I suppose many of her readers were wondering at the end of In My Skin how she got from there to here, and how she could leave behind that life, the person who looks forward only to the next hit, to become someone with the distance to stand back and reflect on the whole thing honestly. Kate Holden's new book tells us what happened next when she went to Italy to find another kind of life for herself. Kate Holden, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard. Lovely to be here.
I've been wanting to get you on for ages. I remember we did this kind of live event where you read some stuff from your work years and years and years ago, and I thought, oh, she's great. I've got to get her on. And somehow I never got around to it, so I'm just so pleased you could come in today. Oh,
thank you. Well, I'm in Melbourne, so usually it's a little bit of a stretch.
It's a bit of a stretch, yes. Your first book begins with you as a little girl, and I think I just described you as shy but not wanting to miss out. Is that a fair description?
Oh, yeah. You could say dorky as well, dorky and painfully bemused by the world. I didn't really quite know how things worked, which is a shame because my parents put a lot of effort into making me feel comfortable. I had a really great upbringing. I've got a mum and a dad and a little sister, you know, like a really loving family and lots of books, quite a sensitive kind of innocent background. But my parents always told me to believe in who I was and that if I did the right thing, things would work out. And I went through life, but I was a library geek. You know, I was a bit insecure with my friends and I was always a bit scared that I was going to miss out, that they were, I don't know, I sometimes wondered if my friends were just humouring me by having me around. I was one of those kids that never quite worked out where I belonged.
Yeah, you write about it, and I love that line you have in your book where you say that you grew up in a house insulated with books. I think that's a really,
yeah,
very
look,
good line.
Yeah, look, the walls are covered.
And protected from the outside
world. Yeah, my house now is the same.
Insulated with books.
Yeah.
Yeah, you seem almost like grateful that your friends took you on as a teenager?
Oh, well, look, I'm not sure what I had to offer them. I was one of those kids, honestly, I had long blonde hair and all you ever saw of me was my nose because I had it pulled right over my face. I just really kind of wanted to hide a lot of the time. So I hid in books. In my skin, I describe hiding in a cardboard box. At birthday parties, I was so mortified by the attention that when they sang happy birthday, I would be underneath the table and they would sing happy birthday to an empty chair. I just didn't know how to, you know, it's sad, isn't it? I mean, talk about looking back on your former self. I just was a really kind of mortified child. I don't really know why. I think I was quite angry as well. I had, you know, fights with my mum and, you know, it's not always great when you're a kid. You're very powerless. So I was kind of stuck in this feeling that whatever I did, I was supposed to be okay. But whatever, you know, sometimes I'd do things and they weren't okay. So I didn't understand anymore. And so when I grew up to be a teenager, I carried that with me and I had these fantastically cool friends. They were lovely. And they started doing, you know, smoking pot and smoking cigarettes and everything. And I didn't know how to follow them. So I was very righteous. And then I felt like I was being left out. And then they picked me up and said, do you want to do something? I was so madly flattered. I don't know what I was doing. And by the way, I was such a dag.
Well, then you're kind of cool because you joined a band. And,
yeah.
You had your own band and you were a bass player. And, you know, girl bass players always.
Is the coolest.
It's the coolest thing in the world, of course. There's the Susie Quattro sort of gene that was in you for a while.
Absolutely.
There. Is there another old Is there another universe in which I'm talking to Kate Holden, the kind of, you know, Joan Jett of Australia?
I still have my bass, but I just play it in my bedroom, you know, on my own, which is also a bit pitiful. Look, I think I had a really vivid imaginative life, and I read cool stuff. I was one of those people who always liked to read about, like, the dark side and people who were very daring and bold and adventurous, but I never imagined I could be like that. I wrote my honours thesis at university about Anais Nin, who was a woman in the 30s, who famously had a very vigorous sex life, but also was a bit of a fantasist. She wore dress-ups. She kind of lived in this other world of her own ego. And I was fascinated by her because she was everything I wasn't. And so I was quite shy, really. But as I got into my early 20s, I started thinking I was getting the hang of it. You know, you pick up the tricks. If you're a shy person, you spend a lot of time watching how other people do things. And you're in a good position in a way, and you just learn the tricks. So I got a nose ring and I got a leather jacket and I played in a band. And I lived in St Kilda in Melbourne in the 90s, which was definitely the place to be.
Yeah, I remember what St Kilda was like in the time. I was actually living in Melbourne. I was living in Fitzroy, which was the independent republic of Fitzroy, and you were in the independent republic of St Kilda.
The other side.
The other side, the other end of the tram line there. And they were kind of very different communities there. But, of course, one of the things I became aware of in that time in the early 90s was the really sudden and shocking influx of heroin into St Kilda. Less so, there was a bit of it in Fitzroy, but less so, much more so in St Kilda, Kate.
Yeah, it came in through very fast, to be honest. Look, I have no idea what was the mechanism behind that, but in the early mid-90s, an enormous amount of very cheap, clean, pure heroin entered the country, swept specifically, I think, into St Kilda. St Kilda is obviously a place that's always had a lot of rock and roll and artists and students there, and it was still very, boho in those days. And it just kind of took out a whole section of the community quite fast.
Stopped them creating too. That was the
shocking
thing.
Everything went quiet, yeah.
I knew people involved in various creative endeavours and they'd say, oh, how's that? I haven't seen that person for a while. Oh, well, junkie
now.
And if they come and borrow, they'll come and ask you for money if you run into them in the street. So you start to avoid that person.
That's right. It just kind of splintered everything. I had, this great life living in share houses, being a student, playing pool, playing in my band, bumping into my friends all the time. And when I started using heroin, it just fractured straight away. I mean, then there were my friends that I used with, and then there were my other friends that I avoided or who avoided me. And it wasn't just because I wasn't borrowing money off them at the start, but they were just a little frightened of me. And I suddenly quite realised that I should be a little bit ashamed before them. And so, all of a sudden I just did not see those people anymore.
The shocking thing about your story is, in a way, is often when you read a kind of a memoir of someone who's got fallen into, heroin use or something of its kind, there's some traumatic event, there's been some abuse, there's been some a car accident or something awful, and that's turned the course of someone's life into drug use. But there wasn't like that for you. It was much more horrifyingly simple. Are you able to explain what led you to take it for the first time, Kate?
Well, I think a lot of people would imagine that I must be pretty stupid to have gone near heroin. And I think, obviously I think that's not unreasonable. I mean, like I knew what the dangers were, and I knew all about people like, Billie Holiday and Kurt Cobain and Sid Vicious and all the people who had been terribly damaged by heroin. I knew that it was an evil and lethal thing, and yet I went there. The fact is that people who take up heroin are generally not stupid foolish. They're actually often the people who are very intelligent, intuitive, introverted, and sensitive, imaginative people.
It's the mistake that people make about the people who join cults as well. They think, oh, you must be stupid to join a cult.
Yeah, no, it's
but
actually
in fact, the reverse. It's the bright
engaged people
that join
them. Yeah, I mean, look, heroin, of course, is a narcotic, so it has the medicinal property, if you like, of taking away the edge. And I think for a lot of people who are shy, perhaps, and highly, imaginative, the world is pretty abrasive. I think for me that was part of the attraction. And certainly at the start as well, it gives you a lot of gifts. It kind of enhances everything. You feel quite nice. You feel happy conversing for hours. The cigarettes go down pretty well. Everything's great. And then later on, of course, it takes all of that away and more so. But at the start, it seems like a good idea. And for me also, I think a lot of it was the idea that I was a shy kid. I didn't want to miss out. I didn't want to be left behind. And so when my friends, in fact, didn't say to me, you should have a go, they said to me, don't have a go. Don't be here with us. Go home. You're not cool enough. For me, I thought, I don't want to be left out. And if it's so scary, I should do it, because that's what growing up is about, is doing the things that scare you.
One of the big moments for me was seeing the film Sid and Nancy, which came out, you know, about the life of Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, which really showed the full filthy squalor of a junkie's life. Were you aware of how squalid that life could be?
Well, of course, I thought I was pretty smart. I mean, I was at university. I just finished an honours degree at university. I fancied myself pretty bright and alert. I knew I was naive, but that's the thing, is if you start heroin and you're a bright person, you of course tell yourself that nothing's ever going to get that bad, that you'll outwit it. You're only having it for a little time. You're just playing with it. It's just a nice thing to do on a sunny day.
Treat.
It's a treat, yeah. It's a lot of fun at the start, but what you don't realise is it's already possessing you and taking things away. And what heroin does is a great trick. It teaches you the essence of satisfaction in a very concrete form, not a, oh, I have a nice life, or I have a nice family, or I love my job kind of way, but one that's a commodity, and we live in a commodity culture. So we like this idea that you go and purchase this substance, you pursue it, you purchase it, and then you physically, you know, take it into your body. This is a marvelous trick to learn, because you then feel like you've achieved everything in life that you want. Nothing could be more satisfying than that.
You feel successful.
You do. You've achieved it. That's it. It's all sorted, until, of course, 8 hours later when you need to do it again. But once you start learning that, nothing quite compares. It's the best deal in the world. Of course, what heroin is doing is making you pay a very high price. So first of all, you're not going to ever use money you don't have to spare. Then you're not going to borrow money. You're not going to miss out on doing something else because you're going to get on. But, you know, eventually you do all of those things and you're still telling yourself, well, it's okay. I mean, this is just temporary. And you think no one knows about it. Of course, everyone knows what you're doing, because they can see it in your face. They can see the way you're not looking them in the eye anymore. And then later on in life, you discover it takes away your job. You fiddle the till when you never thought you'd do that. You know, you'd steal money from your parents' wallet. You were never going to do that. And, you know, eventually you find yourself doing things that horrify you, and yet there you are, and you realise that heroin owns you, and it'll take more than you can afford.
Kate Holden is my guest in conversation, the author of her memoir, In My Skin. Her most recent book is called The Romantic Italian Days, Nights and Days. We'll get onto that in a moment, where you've gone to from there. So it's like 1,000 little decisions then, rather than, I will now abandon my normal life.
Yeah. You don't wake up on a Tuesday morning deciding.
Give it all away.
No.
Right.
No, no. And I think most of us go through life like this. We just make what seems like a good decision at the time. You know, maybe it's a bit indulgent, maybe it's a little bit wicked, but you think, oh, well, you know, I'll just see where that takes me. And for someone who had wanted to be an adventurous, I think I thought of it as an adventure. And honestly, most people who end up as heroin addicts alarming to people in the community, because they're not trustworthy, they're erratic, you know, they're physically a little frightening perhaps if they're very messy and on the nod. You know, they seem like aliens in your eyes, of course, your pupils are pinned, so you look physically alien.
It's seen from other people as a kind of demonic possession. It's like the person we once knew and loved isn't there anymore.
Hollowed
Or is sitting under the weight of some alien. Mm. Does it feel like that on the inside? Is it still you? Or is it some small aspect of yourself that's sort of grown like a weed or something? I don't know. What is it like on the inside, Kate?
Well, in my skin, I describe it as like a dragon wrapped around my head, you know, blinding me with its scaly coils. It felt like I was occupied by something. It's almost like being possessed in a way, because you can find yourself behaving in ways you simply don't recognize. And I think this is actually, in some ways, I've chosen to take this as a good experience, because it alerted me to the fact that there was a person inside me that I did not recognize, you know, that I had powers of ruthlessness, say, that I had not realized, but also strength ultimately. And it's not bad to have a wake-up call about that. At the same time, I really feel strongly that I don't want to sound like a victim. You know, I made the decisions I made. I'm responsible for the things that I did. And in fact, when I was using it, my parents would look at me and say, we don't know who you are anymore. We don't believe a word you say. We don't even know if the sky is blue if you say it is. I would be trying to insist that, of course, it was still me, because I needed them to still love me, you know, and recognize that I was still in there. It was just a, you know, a kind of a skewed, like a distorted version of me. And I was so frightened, you know, and when people are frightened, they behave very strangely.
But then you can take a hit and then you're not frightened.
That's right. I mean, the thing is that heroin is the only thing that consoles. And as you lose your friends, your family, your job, your money, your home, I mean, I ended up homeless in St Kilda, literally with 10 cents for my name. Heroin is the only thing that'll make you feel better. So it keeps, you know, it immediately mortgages everything else in your life.
The interesting part of it, the interesting story there is the reason why you were homeless is your parents went to a support group for families of junkies, of heroin users. And their advice was to ask you to sign they put a contract, which they asked you to sign. What was in the contract, Kate?
Well, look, we've still got it. It's a piece of paper, a handwritten piece of paper. Look, my parents had a really hard time. That nothing in their lives had prepared them for this. And I can't think of anything worse than to be the parent of someone that you love who's on heroin. I mean, it must be absolutely terrifying. But my parents tried everything. They tried kind of going along with me. They tried supporting me when I went to rehab. They tried helping me measure out my, you know, doses of the drug and, you know, kind of sequestering my money and doling that out to me so I couldn't buy the drug. They took me to psychologists and psychiatrists and counsellors. They did everything. Eventually, they got in contact with a group called Families Anonymous, as you said, and they learnt there about boundaries. It's a little bit of the tough love kind of school of thinking, but mostly it was about the fact that my problems were destroying their life, and that was not tenable, you know. There was no end in sight to this. So for all they knew, this might be the rest of their lives. My sister, of course, was also being a bit neglected. She had her own problems growing up, but she wasn't getting any attention, so she was quite angry with me, quite rightly. And so they thought that the thing to do was to say to me, listen, you can keep living with us, but if you want to do that, you have to go into rehab. And until you get the place in rehab, you can't use. You know, that's how it has to be. Which was quite fair of them, but of course it didn't put me in a very great position to choose. It was either stay there and do what as they suggested or be out on the street. So I signed the contract, but I just couldn't do it. You know, Richard, I was just so in the grip of this thing.
And when you broke it, what did they say?
Well, I went and scored. I woke up in the morning. I was still pinned. You know, my mother took one look at me. And she just said, you're busted. And I said, I'm busted, aren't I? And we didn't have anything else to say. I mean, we had nothing else to say. I went and packed a case and she drove me. I think I had an appointment with my counsellor and I went to St Kilda and I stayed on the couch of my dealer and I didn't talk to my parents for a month before I finally contacted them to say I was actually still alive. But it was just the worst day of her life and mine, I think. But it was, I think in a way it was the right thing to do. She had to draw the line and I had to learn all about consequences because heroin, apart from anything else, actually interferes with the chemistry of your brain. So you're really not thinking clearly. You're not thinking like a sober person. And I needed to come up against the hard edges of what I was doing. My counsellor kept saying, you know, it's just going to get worse and worse. And maybe you need it to get worse until you realise. So I kind of drifted and drifted and drifted downwards. And I was either going to end up bouncing up again or dead. You know, that was how it was going to be.
And that was the advice your parents were getting, that you were the kind of junkie that would probably have to reach bottom before you could get better.
Yeah, which, I mean, how that made them feel, I can't imagine. I know they spend every night lying awake waiting for the police to ring and say they'd found my body.
But, you know, to be told that, I think, would help.
Well,
in some ways, I think, because you
process.
Fear that and then you must accept that.
And look, I had a counsellor, a very wise lady, and she said that to me and my parents, there's a process, there's a beginning, a middle and an end to any addiction, you know, whatever kind of thing it is. And you can try and rush to the end. Now, at the end, Kate might be alive and well, or she might be dead, but you can't rush it. And in fact, a lot of people who try and overcome their addictions too soon, I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't seek support, but they do rush it and then they're alone later and they might relapse, you know, 10 years later. And that's when they're really vulnerable. That's when people actually die. So in a way, it was good that I just went through the whole process and didn't try to artificially, you know, fix myself up when I wasn't ready, because clearly I had issues and I had kind of like the emotional issues that were making me use. And then I had the circumstantial issues of being a homeless junkie, which was quite enough to be going on with.
Kate Holden is here. Her first book is called In My Skin. Her newer one is called The Romantic Italian Nights and Days. To support the heroin habit, it's a very stressful thing. As you mentioned, you stole from your work. You were sacked from there, which was painful for everyone concerned because they'd employed you since you were a teenager.
No, I just feel sick when I think about it even now.
Then you decided to become a streetwalker to support the habit. How was that decision for you? Were you in floods of tears, or was it just Or does the prospect of having the money to get a hit just get you over that bump really quick, really easily?
Well, look, I was in survival mode by that stage. You know, I'd lost my job at the bookshop where I'd been since I left school. My parents were terrified of what was going on. My friends who didn't use, you know, were avoiding me. And I was just knew that I had to get money. I had to get money to feed my habit. I could not get off the drugs at that point. And I figured that I could do the one thing that seemed to me, and this might sound strange, but it seemed to me honourable, which was to go out and use my body as my tool and not hurt anyone. I very much didn't want to hurt anyone. I didn't want to rob people. I didn't want to rort people. I wanted to survive on my own terms and with some sense of dignity. And so I went, like a lot of girls do, out onto the street to work, which is a dangerous thing to do. But I thought, well, I can do it. I'll keep out of everyone's way. You know, I won't be alarming people. I'm in this shadow world now. And so I entered the nighttime world where I no longer saw anyone I knew. And I just did what I did. And I worked on the street for 8 months or so. I saw my dealer and I scored. A friend let me stay on a couch at his place, which was wonderful of him. I hardly ever saw him though, because he worked during the day and I was asleep all day. And that's what I did for nearly a year.
How was your relationship with the police at that time, who were, I suppose, supposed to be arresting you and telling you not to do what you were doing?
Well, it's funny because I actually now do talks to the new recruits at the St Kilda Police Station to kind of to get them to think about what it's like being a street worker, because that's who they're dealing with all the time on their patrols. And they've got quite a progressive policy down there now about harm minimisation and community kind of liaison with the sex worker sector. But in those days, look, it was a skirmish. It was a bit of a game with the police, but it was a serious game. And I very much did not want to think that this was going to be the rest of my life. I did not want to get a criminal record, but I knew that what I was doing was technically illegal. As far as I was concerned, it wasn't hurting anyone, but you can be charged with soliciting and loitering, and indeed I was. In fact, the second night I worked, I was stopped by the police. I didn't know anything about how to handle them. I'd never talked to the police in my life. They scared me, you know, I was shaking. And subsequently, I was charged 3 times and went to the magistrate's court to be judged publicly as being a street worker, which was mortifying.
From there, you were hired to work in a brothel. Paint me a picture of that space, if you can, of what it's like to be in that room, to go from there, well, I suppose from the streets to the somewhat more cosy confines
somewhat
of a brothel.
More cosy. Well, I mean, the thing is that quite a lot of people listening to this may even know what the inside of a brothel looks like.
So it'll be,
people
it'll be
go
ho-hum for them.
There.
Yes.
But they're actually a little bit like you imagine in the movies. Brothel decor is fairly classic. They
a
have
pendant lamp with fringes around it.
They
that
like
kind of thing.
Gilt mirrors, you know, and divans. Brothels are funny. They don't have any windows, so they have lovely low lighting, very flattering for everyone. They have, you know, the classy ones have a Chesterfield lounge, you know, like a little bit of 18th century erotic art. Not too erotic, but nudes on the wall, prints on the wall, and usually a receptionist. So when I went to the first one, unfortunately, the first place I went to was possibly the most infamous brothel in Melbourne, with my luck, because I didn't know any better. And that was a little bit tacky, but I walked in and I had been on the street having a dreadful time, rained on, you know, boiling hot, having to work in cars. And I walked into this place. There were leather couches. There was a television. There was a coffee machine. There was a bathroom. There was a shower. There were no police officers trying to catch me in the act. And there was a clientele that came to me instead of me looking to them. And even though that first experience was pretty dreadful, I realised that this was quite a different side of the sex industry, and I was a lot safer.
You took the name Lucy, and you could be... Were you kind of like another person? Was that what it was? And could you reinvent yourself as that person?
Well, it's funny because it was almost like I'd broken myself down, having been out there on the streets, homeless and so addicted. You know, I was almost compressed. I felt like it was a little bit like carbon being compressed down to a diamond. You know, I had to get so tight and tough when I was out on the street. Like my shoulders were held so high and my face was so set as I walked down the street and I scared people. But I'd almost obliterated who I was in a way. I was just this person who survived. And then when I went into the brothels, it was like I could inflate again into a real person, but even try on different personalities. So as I bought more clothes to work in, like different frocks and more makeup, I could turn myself into this kind of glamorous girl, which I had never been before. I learned how to walk in high heels. I wore really sparkly eyeshadow. And I turned into a kind of a sequence of Lucy's. You know, I could be shy and sweet for the clients who liked a shy, sweet girl. I could be quite brave and, you know, bold with someone else.
It's an odd thing to say, but was that fun?
Well, it was very powerful. It was very powerful because, you know, I'd been so unsure of who I was, and here I could be all these people, and my clients responded. And so I got to find out that I was much more than I had ever suspected. Even though it was a performance, it was a rehearsal.
Did you find that took away the stress of needing to come up with enough money every day to score? You probably had more money from this process. Did that then take the stress out of your life of that?
Well, I did make more and more money as I was going along. And I got quite committed to the job, you know, Richard. I stopped thinking of it as simple survival. I was thinking of it as a career. You know, I did it for several years and I started thinking it was a profession. But unfortunately, I also acquired a boyfriend who needed supporting.
Sessions with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Today my guest in conversation is Kate Holden, the writer who brought you In My Skin and her newest book, I should say, The Romantic Italian Nights and Days, which is the follow-up to In My Skin, which she talked about her life as a young girl who experimented with heroin, then became a prostitute to support that habit. Later on, went to Italy for a while. We'll get onto that soon, I promise, too. Can we talk about the most interesting insights in both your books, I think, are the insights into the men that are there, not just your boyfriends, but the men in the brothel to begin with. You saw so many different aspects of the naked male ape.
I did, many aspects, top yes. and bottom, back to front.
Yeah, the kind of the most sympathetic and the most contemptible, I think. Sometimes I'm sure in the same man as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Look, it was an education to me. I was a shy girl. I had had quite a few relationships before I got into the sex industry, but I was a little alarmed by men, to be honest, especially the naked beast. I found them alien, and I was a little unsure what to do with them, to be honest. But when I went into the professional industry dealing with men, I encountered all types, and it was a real education to me, not just physically, but I had never met so many types of men, and you know, the clientele of a normal inner urban Melbourne brothel is basically all of male humanity. There's no particular type of guy that goes to a brothel. All types of men go to brothels, and so I got to meet everyone.
Could they be sweet at times?
So sweet. And honestly, I get tears in my eyes to this day talking about how lovely some of my clients were.
In what way?
Well, I think I was mostly heartbroken by their loneliness. I had no idea there were these very gentle, sweet, lonely, lonely men who, you know, in the rough and tumble of the dating scene, just never had a chance. And so they were absolute little princes, you know. And if I'd been their girlfriend, they would have treated me like a princess. And they had so much to give, but for whatever reason, they weren't very good with girls out there. And so they would kind of adopt a working lady. It's very common, and be a regular client. And bring gifts, you know, treat her beautifully, give her compliments, make life as easy for her as possible, hope to rescue her, of course. I just love them so much, and I wish that they would go out and find some love with some nice girl.
How did men change from the man on the street to the man in that room without clothes on?
Well, it's fascinating what happens when you take two people. You give them both fake names. Both the women and often the men would use a false name.
Yeah, what did they choose? Was it John?
John.
G'day, John.
John, every time, and they thought it was so funny. And, well, you know, I chose a pretty boring name as well, to be honest. The names aren't important, but then you take them into a room with no windows. You take all their clothes off. You put them in there for, half an hour or an hour or so. And the most incredible thing happens is that you actually find the real person in some ways. Now, I would have a clientele that went from everything from, plumber's apprentices to stockbrokers. Some of them would come in feeling pretty bold and cocky. But when I put my hand on their shoulder, I would find them trembling and they were nervous. They were just putting on a front. And when I took them up to the room, that was my territory and I was the one in charge. So they would either overcompensate by being, a bit difficult, and there was certainly no shortage of men who just did not know how to handle their nervousness and would take it out on the lady by being rude or obnoxious or selfish or even sometimes a bit violent. But there were also a lot of guys who, once you gave them permission just to relax, would really do that, and they would confide. A lot of the work is talking, just hanging out. They would talk about all sorts of things, and I was really privileged.
The other side of that is the men. A brothel will always attract a certain kind of man who just out and out hates women or has got a problem. Tell me about the growling man. He's the most kind of troubling.
Look, he disturbed me a lot because he came in, he booked me. He was just a guy, in his 30s. And when we got into the room, he immediately just lay right on top of me. I was trying to squeak things about, do you want to have a shower? And, would you like to relax? Would you like to have a chat for a little bit? And he just leapt right on top of me.
Squeak because you could barely talk, you mean?
He got right on top of me, squashed me down so I could barely breathe, kind of wound his hands into my hair so I couldn't move, and just lay there and growled for 20 minutes. And I could tell he just wanted to hurt me. He wanted to frighten me deeply, which he did. And I was all about managing the situation. We had a panic button, but it was on the other side of the room. I knew that if I showed him that I was frightened, then he would have won, So I was trying to be very calm. I managed to get him off me just enough to be able to say something like, I think the buzzer's about to go. I'd better hop up. And I just got out of there and I said to the receptionist, get him out, but don't tell him I'm frightened.
Yeah, that's a really horrible and scary story.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I had very few incidents like that, but there were just a couple.
You were still using the whole time. You had a boyfriend. It was one of those guys, Robbie, I think he's called in the book.
That's right.
He strikes me as a drowning guy who wants you to drown with him. Is that right, or is that not fair?
Oh, look, I possibly didn't do Robbie justice in the way I described him in the book, because he is a really precious person, and I'm still in contact. We're still friends to this day, after having been quite angry with him for some time for the way he'd behaved. He's a person who has never had the advantages of having love or respect in his life. He didn't get much when he was growing up. I did, So even when I was a junkie, I knew what dignity and respect and love and loyalty meant. But he had never been shown those things. So he didn't understand that if he robbed me while I was asleep after I'd been working for 12 hours that night to support both of us, that was not loyal. He thought it was a kind of love, because he'd take the money, he'd go and score, he'd use most of it, but he'd save a bit for me out of the money that he'd stolen from my purse.
Yes, I know that, but that's yet a junkie rationalisation. And for someone who stands outside of that, he's a very recognisable type.
He is a type, I know. But you'd be surprised, because now he's a drug and alcohol counsellor, helping other people. And for me, Robbie's story is really about that persistence. I persisted with him way past where I should have done. And it was a classic, codependent and even abusive relationship. But I was also very lonely. I had almost no other romantic prospects. And I needed him, apart from anything else, I needed him to go and get the drugs. It's a classic junkie thing. And it so often works out on these particular gender lines, I'm afraid.
It's a horrible, you were having a life, you were managing it by the sound of things.
Yeah.
Why did you make the decision to stop?
Well, I wish I could give you a 30-second answer to that. There is no simple answer.
Did you get sick of it?
Sick to death of it. Fell out of love with heroin. It was a bit like a relationship where you just wake up one morning and you think, I just don't care about you anymore. I was lucky because I did heroin for 5 years, and I think that was the end of my journey. As my counsellor had suggested, there was an end. And I reached it kind of naturally. It was also, I was tired, I was really missing the person that I had been before, the girl who dreamed and read and wrote and created. I was worried that my boyfriend was getting more and more out of control. And as it happened, there was suddenly a great big drop in the supply of heroin. So it was a lot more labour to get it. I could have kept going, and a lot of people did, but I just didn't have it in me to go and chase heroin for 9 hours a day. So I was really lucky. I started on a methadone program. I didn't know if it was going to work. I was terrified. And I should explain that with heroin, when you decide to give up, you're always deciding to give up all the time, every day. But every time you stop using heroin, your body doesn't congratulate you. Your body goes into catastrophe. Everything feels terrible. You feel like you're dying. And so you don't think, oh, I've just done the best decision of my life. You feel like you've just done the worst. That's right. And where will it end? So
that's why junkies, when they talk about getting back on it, they talk about getting well, don't they?
Yeah.
It's a creepy phrase, getting well. Are you getting well? Are you?
Yeah. It's not about getting high. It's about just not being dreadfully, dreadfully ill. And so I really didn't know if it was going to stick. But it's almost like I had to sneak up on getting off heroin. I just pretended I wasn't really doing it, but I did it. And it happened quite easily in the end. And I wish that I knew how that worked so I could explain it to other people. But it just did.
So then that brings us to, I mean, I think you made that decision then to leave Australia and have another kind of life. And this is where your next book kind of begins, to some degree anyway.
Well, they call it, in heroin using, they call it doing a geographical, where you just run away from your scene.
Does that work a lot of the time?
Never, because there is always heroin somewhere. Yeah. You know, you can always make another scene. But in my case, I just thought, I've got to get away. And because I wanted to follow kind of my creative, imaginative part, I'd been reading a lot of poetry about the romantic poets who were themselves adventurers, who believed in being sincere and kind of following their hearts and feeling emotions. And of course, I had shut down all my emotions and I hadn't followed my heart. I'd almost killed my heart. And so for me, reading these poets was part of my recovery. And when I thought about going away, I thought, well, I'll go to Europe. You know, that's where they are. And so I went to Rome.
Reading that, it strikes me that junkies live from one thing to the next hit, one hit to the next hit to the next hit, and the future is just chopped up into...
Oh, 8-hour blocks.
8-hour, at that. 8-hour. I thought I was going to say 24, even. But it's 8, is it? There you go. But then if you read the romantic poems, you know, which is not to everyone's... Some people love them, some people don't.
Oh, and they do go on a bit.
They do go on a bit. Oh, my heart. I fear it shall burst and all that. But at least it gives you a kind of view of a distant shore. Is that a good way of putting it?
Oh, that's a wonderful thought.
Some distant thing you can reach over time, not over 8 hours, but over time. A beautiful place you can travel to.
Yes. I think you put your finger on it. Absolutely. It's a vista. It's a radiant horizon that you can head towards. And you know, going to Rome, you know, the romantic poets really were obsessed with Rome, the city, because it is a symbol of eternity and it endures no matter what happens to it. You know, plagues, floods, fires, vandals, everything's happened to the city of Rome. And yet there it is to this day, standing there, beautiful and bashed up, you know, but it's still there. And so Rome has always been a symbol of perpetuity and dignity, and I think that's one of the other things that drew me there.
So then you have this for a little while. You have this idol. You track down an acquaintance, a man, a lover called Jack. In the book, is British. He's a bit older than you, and he's got a place in the country. And there, with olive groves, the sea is over the horizon.
Lovely Italian wine
and food, and you go down and you get perfect bread and coffee wherever you go. So there's this. Idle for a while. Mm. How long did it keep you happy for, that little idle?
Well, it was a brief one. Look, I was looking for shelter. I was not in a good shape when I left Australia. I was just a wraith of a girl. I was shredded by that time on the drugs. And so I got there. I had removed myself from all my scene, you know, the dangerous scene. But then there I was in Italy all on my own. And I discovered that I wanted protection. I wanted shelter. You know, I wanted a place to rest and recover. And so I found Jack, and he was a man who was older than me. As you say, he lived in this lovely farmhouse in the south of Italy, and it was great. But he And I started immediately kind of analysing each other. I'm a bit of an overthinker. So I looked at him and I saw this complex of male anxieties all buttoned down so he could be a proper English gentleman. And he looked at me and saw this kind of completely unformed, chaotic young woman who could be so great if she just got herself together.
So were you both right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So we started trying to fix each other. But, of course, that's a dreadful thing to do in a new relationship.
Yeah, you can renovate a farmhouse, a human being, something else.
No, it was pointless. It was just catastrophe. So, you know, but it was a start. It was a start. And the thing is, I wanted to try and explain to him that I had been through a hard time, but I didn't know how to. I was so scared of what he would say. So I was trying to show him that I was vulnerable and, you know, try and provoke his protection and sympathy. But he would just say, pull yourself together. You know, I don't flog dead horses. You know, you're just bunging it on. You're being self-indulgent. And then I'd feel all, you know, injured and worse.
Worst conscript for the British Army. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't do a good job there picking him. Lovely guy, though.
Yeah. You have kind of several lovers while you're in Italy, and he's British and the rest of them are Italian, I think. But what's really interesting is you tell all of them just about your past as a junkie and a prostitute. Mm. What's interesting is the way they respond. Was there any one way that these men would respond? How did Jack respond to begin with?
Well, look, I told Jack, you know, after we'd been together for a little bit, and he said, I knew it, you were too good. And I don't think he meant it as a compliment.
Trying too hard.
Yeah, like you're just a little bit too cool and professional. There's something about you. And he used to say, look, your face is so sweet when you do that, but it's nearly going hard. And I think he was rather proud that he'd picked that there was something about me. But then he was very intimidated. You know, he couldn't admit it, but he was very intimidated by the fact that I'd been a sex worker and had experience of other men. And that kind of was the beginning of the end for us. It's funny because when I was writing The Romantic, I wrote in the scenes of disclosure with each character all in one day. I went through the book and I wrote in all of those scenes because I hadn't been sure if I was going to put in the, you know, my background into this book. And so I went from writing the scene with Jack to writing the scene with Massimo to writing the scene with... So I put them all in one day and it was ridiculous because I had to keep thinking, well, how did this guy respond? And I realized as I was writing that they all did have this hesitation, and then they all reassured me that it was fine, that they were a man of the world and they could, you know, they were perfectly fine to hear that their girlfriend had been a prostitute. And then each one of them actually started treating me quite differently after they knew that about me. And look, I don't blame them. I think that's a big thing to take on. But it was the fact that they wouldn't admit that they were freaked out about it that I was disappointed in. And I so much needed them to understand where I'd been.
They can't. How can they understand that?
They couldn't.
Unless they've read your book.
No. But the funny thing is, of course, the irony that's in this book is that at no point... it describes a series of sexual and romantic encounters that I have with people. And I didn't initiate any of them. They were all initiated by the man in each relationship. And yet they start to see me as promiscuous. You know, this is the irony in there that as soon as I say that I had been a sex worker, of course that confirms it. I'm just this kind of, you know, cheap girl around town. And what I'm trying to be is not that girl.
Kate Holden is here. Her latest book is The Romantic, Italian Nights and Days. Kate, one thing I can sort of read into this is that you've got these guys and they're your lovers, and then you tell them this, and the first feeling that inspires them is fatherly concern for you.
Oh, yeah.
That freaks them out because they're really enjoying being your lover, and then all of a sudden they have this kind of... Well, some of them do anyway. I don't know if that's true of all of them. It probably isn't. But for some of them, particularly Jack, he suddenly feels this fatherly concern for this woman he's in a very sexual relationship with.
And conflict.
Alarms go off in their head. Yeah.
Wrong. That's right. That's right. And I must have had something on my face. I looked like, please look after me. And, you know, perhaps I was just looking for a father figure.
Fix my broken life.
Yes, just please take me in. But, you know, what I'd learned, of course, being a sex worker is that sex is a currency that you can use to pay your way. Now, this is not to say that sex workers are damaged people at all, but I had learnt that was something I could offer, and I could offer it almost, you know, without emotion. So I could use it to buy myself security and protection.
Italy's a first time I went to Italy, I don't pretend to understand it. But one of the things that's, you know, you can be in a place like Venice and see a little niche in every corner with a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary right next to a stand that's selling seriously outrageous pornography.
Oh, yes.
And,
yes.
You know, a lot has been written about the Madonna whore complex that not just Italian men have, but many men have. I'm just wondering, then, you are in that... that culture. Were the Italian men different from your British lover in that sense? Were there cultural differences there that led to different responses to that disclosure?
Yeah. Well, look, I think almost I had a bit of a Madonna whore complex. I didn't know which one I was. You know, I was trying to find the middle ground. But did I want to be a virgin again, or did I want to be, you know, like this kind of sexually very powerful woman that I had discovered I was? I think with the British men, they had kind of a backlog of anxieties. They had more cultural kind of strictures around their emotional feelings. The Italian men, you know, were very attractive to me because they were far more intuitive. And I've got to say, Southern Italian men have an almost supernatural understanding of women.
Really?
Which is wonderful, but also rather alarming because you know that they understand you and they know that your tricks.
Do they have women friends, though? Or,
well, to be honest, I ended up being great friends with some of my Southern Italian male friends. We, you know, we went to bed, but we also ended up friends, and that was really the joy of it. And this book, you know, has some quite grim parts, but there are some joyful parts, and a lot of them are to do with these guys in Naples that I met. They were fun guys. It's just that it was a game. You know, but what happens in the book is that I found out that what seemed like just a lovely, jolly kind of game of romping around Naples actually had a lot of darkness underneath, and that there is no game that comes for free. All these men, they had their own problems, and each character in the book indeed is trying to play a game, but they're also quite lonely and trying themselves to find the right balance of sex, love and romance.
And once you know that, does that make you feel better or safer or just more alienated?
Well, I think by the end of the story, you know, I had really understood forgiveness. You know, I had understood how to forgive myself, I think, for a lot of the confusion that I'd had, and to forgive all of those gentlemen, you know, because I knew that they were really just trying their best. But you know, none of us ever gets it right. And we all want to be loved.
How about making female friends in Italy? Was that easy?
I had not a single female friend in Italy. It was one of the terrible, most difficult things. There is a line in the book where I'm reflecting on this fact because, look, I'm sure I didn't meet enough women, but the ones I did were very hostile, competitive, and my character reflects that, you know, they just think I'm going to steal their boyfriends, and my character thinks, ha, you bitches, I do. I'm not proud of that, but, you know, they kind of, I felt a little bit pushed into it. They wouldn't talk to me. It was terrible. I was really alone. So the only people who would talk to me were men, and then men wanted to have sex with me, and then I was called promiscuous. So this is my bind.
Now, you're a very successful writer these days. Your book sold many, many copies, international reviews, very, very full of praise for your work. Back then you were trying to be a writer. You were saying you wanted to be a writer, but you hadn't been published. Did that sound like a forlorn hope to you then?
Well, it's funnily enough, Jack was the person who looked at me and said, listen, your life, you know, what are you going to do with it? And I said, I'd like to be a writer. And he said, make a 5-year plan, young lady, make a 5-year plan. And, you know, and in 5 years time, we'll meet up and you can tell me how it's gone. And one of the things I wrote down there was publish a book. And 5 years later, I had published a book and I got to write to Jack and say, look what I did. And he loved the book, to be honest. I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, and recovery from heroin, getting off the drugs, getting your life slightly sorted is one thing. But it's a long road. And I know I was very lucky because, first of all, I got the opportunity to go away. And secondly, when I came back, I had friends and family who forgave me. But a lot of people don't find that. They find that they get they face a lot of prejudice. They owe money to people. Their friends won't ever talk to them again and so on. So for me, I thought I'll take the good luck I've got. I actually went to China for 4 months and taught English there, which was another getting away and just starting again gambit. And then when I came back, I started doing a writing course. It's not the most practical thing to do in the world, but it worked for me.
I read how your teacher asked you to read out something you'd you'd read in front of the whole class, and she said, "Oh, I wonder what I'm going to wear to the book launch."
Yes, isn't she was nice? Very confident from the start. I was nervous about writing about the addiction and the sex work, of course, because I had no idea how people would respond. But I was lucky because I started workshopping it with writers who are not judgmental people. I mean, they tend to take everything pretty on the chin. And so I was confident. I got a publisher very soon. I was very lucky to be published by Text Publishing. And when the book came out, I was just amazed by how lovely people were to me. That I got the impression that a lot of people are touched by drug addiction, you know, themselves or in their families or their friends. And there's not a lot of open dialogue about the pain involved. So people respond to that. They read my book and then they're allowed to tell their stories. It's almost like it gives them permission to discuss their issues. And with sex work, it's just perennially fascinating to people. I find it fascinating for what it opens up about gender relations and sex and life. And I know that every time I had told anyone that I'd been a sex worker, I had a 7-hour conversation. You know, how did you do this? What did this feel like? How much did you charge? And so on. So I just got a fantastic response to In My Skin, and that gave me the confidence to write the next one.
When you finished this book, The Romantic, and several lovers are mentioned and talked about, and did you run it by the men you talk about in the book?
Oh, look, it's something I absolutely agonised about, actually. Within My Skin, I tried very hard to protect people's privacy because, you know, it was set in Melbourne, I live in Melbourne, it was published in Melbourne, and the people I was describing, sex workers and drug addicts and clients, don't really want to be identified, obviously. With The Romantic, it's all set overseas, so I was a little bit safer. But on the other hand, I was revealing such intimate things about these men, and I felt very conflicted about that. What right do I have to tell their stories? I could only tell the stories that related to me, obviously. I anguished about it, but I eventually showed both Jack and Tom the book, and they read it quickly, and both of them wrote to me and said, you know, it's just your story, that's fine. They both said, well, I don't think you've understood me at all. Which may be right or maybe not right. I think I've understood them pretty well, to be honest. But they were both really superb, and I think they gave me a lot of trust.
Part of the recovery process for alcoholics is to, you know, write down a full and fearless moral inventory. And your book's not really like that, but it is incredibly candid and honest. It's very honest, and it sort of shows the kind of moral nuances. Is that part of that process for you? I'm known, art isn't therapy, I know that, but nonetheless, was that thought in your head?
Well, it's you know, it's fascinating and frightening to look back at your former selves, isn't it? I mean, you don't like what you see. This is why people should never reread their diaries, which I had to do to write The Romantic. I am amazed at what I did. Sometimes I think, my God, how did I get through that? Did I really do that? Why did I go and have that glass of wine with that concierge?
Young lady, what were you thinking?
What was I thinking? Yes. But, you know, it's a very clarifying process. I don't write these books as therapy at all. I actually mostly hope that, you know, for good or bad, other people can possibly relate to my story. I'm prepared to put it all out on the page and be proud of it.
And it's all there. Kate, great to meet you, and I'm so glad we brought you on Conversations 5 years after meeting you for the
first time.
Thank you,
Richard.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.